What we're talking about here is the potentially illegal retention and use of classified documents regarding American national security.
That's former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a former federal prosecutor, discussing whether it's appropriate to charge a former president over his handling of classified materials.
I believe that he intentionally kept those documents and obstructed the government from getting them back and returning them to the people and protecting our national security secrets.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
I intend to seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States in 2024, and I want your support.
On this bombshell news week, as Trump faced a new indictment, Christie launched his second run for the presidency, distinguishing himself from most of the GOP field by taking direct aim at the frontrunner.
A lonely, self-consumed, self-serving mirror hog is not a leader.
Christie's first bid for the presidency 8 years ago went nowhere. He ended up endorsing Trump and remained a friend and advisor throughout most of his presidency. But on election night in 2020, Christie split with Trump over his election lies.
We did win this election.
It wasn't that I misjudged his character. It was that I was hopeful I could make him better. And I wound up failing in that way. And he wound up failing me and failing the country.
Christie also has a warning about corruption in the White House.
And then are we supposed to expect that it's just coincidence that Jared Kushner gets $2 billion 6 months after he leaves office from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund? Is it because of his great investing acumen?
Governor Christie has staked out a clear position. Donald Trump cannot be president, and he's the one to stop him. But what if he's wrong?
What do you think the consequences of a second Trump term could be?
I think he will take retribution against anyone who he believes wronged him.
Governor Christie, now candidate Christie, welcome back to Firing Line.
Happy to be back, Margaret. Thanks for having me.
You announced that you are going to seek the Republican nomination for the presidency this week in New Hampshire. You're polling at about 2% right now, and there are 8 or 9 candidates that'll be in the race in short order. Unlike most of your competitors, you have not minced words in condemning President Trump's record, while still owning the fact that you supported him at one time. So what do you say to the skeptic that says, you're in this as a torpedo for Trump, you can never win? The GOP base, it just isn't what it used to be.
Well, first of all, I don't buy it, even just based upon the polling data that I've seen. What have you seen? What I've seen is that 25 to 30% of our Republican primary voters say they're voting for Trump. Then you have about 45% of voters who say, I might vote for Trump, but I would be willing to consider an alternative. And then you have the remainder, 25 to 30%, who say, I'll never vote for Trump. So it looks to me like you've got 70, 75% of the people who would either be willing to consider an alternative or won't consider him at all. That seems like a pretty broad base for me to go after and appeal to try to build a winning coalition. So I don't believe the people who think the numbers aren't there to do it. But even more importantly, I know this. 8 years ago, around this time, Donald Trump was polling at 4%. So these polls now don't mean nearly as much as people try to pretend they do.
In 2012, you were begged by the Republican establishment, in particular the donor class, to get into the race and to run against Barack Obama. In 2016, you finally did. It didn't work out. You lost to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
What is different in 2024, both about your personal calculation and your calculation about how to win?
Well, first off, I think in 2012, I just wasn't ready to be president. And that was a personal decision that me and Mary Pat made, that I'd been governor for a year and a half. And I know it sounds like a quaint proposition now in retrospect, but we didn't feel ready to take this on. And I think the only thing worse than running for president when you're not ready is being elected president when you're not ready. Moving forward to now, what's different is 8 years ago, we all became convinced, and by all, I mean folks like me and Jeb Bush and John Kasich and Marco Rubio, that there was an establishment lane that we had to compete in first and become the winner of that lane, and like the NCAA tournament, move on to face the winner of Trump, Cruz, Fiorina, and Carson. It was a completely faulty way of looking at it. We were wrong. I was wrong, and everybody else who did that was wrong. There's one lane, Margaret, and the lane has Donald Trump at the head of it. And if you want to win it, you got to go directly through that lane and go through him. Only by taking him on and disqualifying him will there be the voters that really want to believe in you and push you forward.
How does taking him on make him weaker? Because we've seen over and over again that as people surround him and attack him, his base consolidates around him. How do you imagine this primary contest will unfold in your favor?
The way I think it unfolds in my favor is that there are going to be a certain percentage of people, as we talked about, and we don't know what the number is right now, it's 25 or 30, who say right now they're going to vote for him no matter what. But they've never had anybody prosecute the case against him, a fellow Republican prosecute the case against him. Everyone who's prosecuted the case against him are people who Republicans are wary of. You know, folks who work for CNN or MSNBC and the mainstream media, or folks who...
Oh, like ABC?
Right. Or ABC or CBS or NBC.
But you worked for ABC.
I did. But they, our Republican base is suspicious of those entities. They believe, and they're right to some extent, that some of them have a liberal bent to them. They've never had a Republican come out and really directly make the case in the context of a campaign on the facts against his record. Margaret, he said he was going to, you know, repeal and replace Obamacare. He didn't do it, even with a Republican Congress. He said he was going to build a wall across the entire border and Mexico was going to pay for it. He not only didn't build the wall, we haven't gotten our first peso from Mexico, okay? He said he was going to balance the budget in 4 years. He left with the highest deficit of any president in modern history. Said he was going to retire the national debt in 8 years. He's added trillions to the national debt. There is a record here, well beyond his character flaws, a record of failure as president. I like the way former Attorney General Bill Barr said it. He said, if you like the Trump agenda, he's the last person you'd hire to execute it because he doesn't have the first idea of how to do it. And by the way, we don't have to speculate about that like we did in 16. And that's the other reason it's different. In 2016, he had no record for us to speak of. He had been a star of a TV show and built some buildings in New York and made some money. What were we going to attack in all that? It was very difficult. Now we have a 4-year record of failure as president. Did he do some things that worked out? Sure he did. The tax cut was good. Some of his regulatory reform was good. The Abraham Accords in the Middle East were good. But other than that, on the main core things he promised our Republican base, he failed. No one's prosecuted that case.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu announced this week that he won't join the GOP primary contest. And he wrote in the Washington Post, quote, "The stakes are too high for a crowded field to hand the nomination to a candidate who earns just 35% of the vote, and I will help ensure this does not happen." How do you ensure that doesn't happen?
Well, first way is to beat him. And that's the way you ensure it doesn't happen. But look, we all need to be smart about the way we run this race. Everybody who's in this race needs to be smart and realistic about their own chances. But having just gotten in this week, I'm not yet ready to evaluate my chances in that context. I'm going to have the opportunity to make my case to the American people. I started to make it this week. And the reaction we've gotten so far has been really, really encouraging.
How will you know if it's working?
Same ways you always know, Margaret. Can you continue to raise money? Where do your poll numbers go? Are you trending in the right direction? What's the anecdotal reaction you get on the ground when you're campaigning? I'm a big believer in that. I can tell when people are really connecting with me and when folks are just being polite or maybe not being polite. All those things are indicators of it. And you'll also hear from people in the party that you respect, I suspect, about, you know, how they feel you're doing and what they think your chances are. All those things are things you consider. And then the secret sauce of it, the secret formula, is to figure out how you weight all those things in making your own decision. In the end, I'm a very realistic guy, and I'll make the decision based upon what I think my real chances are. But I got to tell you, I think that there is a large part of our party that quietly, in a whispered tone, has had enough. And what they need is for someone to give voice to it so they can feel comfortable giving voice to it. If everybody stays silent, everyone else will stay silent. If our leaders are silent, our citizens will be silent. I'm not going to be. And I'm going to show people that there is cover provided for those who want to tell the truth. And I'm going to provide that cover.
You've said that Donald Trump has disqualified himself. On what grounds has he disqualified himself?
The first one to me was election night 2020. When you're the president of the United States and you stand behind the seal of the president in the East Room of the White House on election night and you say the election was stolen when you have no evidence to prove that it was, you are undercutting the very democracy that gave you the privilege and the honor of being president. And you're doing it under the people's roof. That's disqualifying to me. And that's what I said that night on ABC when I was giving election commentary. January 6th and his first incitement from Election Day to January 6th speech, he was inciting those people all the way throughout by continuing to perpetuate the lie that the election was stolen. And then that day, urged them to march up to Capitol Hill, lied to them, and told them he was going to march with them, and then sat in his office and did nothing. As some of those people, not all of them, but some of those people, laid waste to the United States Capitol and threatened the lives of our leaders, including his own vice president. And he sat by watching it on TV and did nothing for hours. To me, that tells me that he doesn't have the compassion, the empathy, or the loyalty to the tenets of our democracy to be president. And then finally, the way he's conducted himself in the post-presidency, his conduct with classified documents, and not just having them, because as we've seen, Joe Biden had some, Mike Pence had some. Sometimes classified documents can mistakenly be taken. I believe that he intentionally kept those documents and obstructed the government from getting them back and returning them to the people and protecting our national security secrets. That's a further disqualification for someone to have the authority to possess those secrets and to make those decisions on behalf of our country.
But I just want to be clear. There's no circumstance under which you will support Donald Trump for the 2024 nomination or presidency?
Yeah, I've said that before, and I'm happy to affirm that for you.
So the Republican National Committee has announced the conditions that candidates must meet in order to participate in the primary debates. And one of them is the commitment to support whoever the nominee is.
Right.
You said you'll take the pledge as seriously as Trump did back in 16.
You bet I will.
When he abandoned it.
Every bit as seriously.
So you plan to make the pledge?
Look, I plan to do whatever I have to do to save my party and save my country. And to do that, I've got to be on the debate stage. So they want me to sign the piece of paper? I'll sign the piece of paper the same way Donald Trump signed it in 2016 and then got on the debate stage and nine of us raised our hands to reaffirm the pledge we had signed and he refused to. And no one kicked him off the stage after that. No one prevented him from being in another debate. So I'm happy to rest on that precedent.
What if Trump refuses to participate in debates?
He won't.
Why?
His ego won't permit him to. It simply won't, Margaret. He believes he's the greatest debater in the Republican Party. He believes that he can win any argument he's in. I've watched him over the years. And he may skip one just to get more attention. But when he watches that one debate and watches all of us get the attention and watches me tell the truth about him without him being able to respond, if he skips one, he'll be back to the next one, believe me.
You've also criticized your competitors for shying away from being willing to confront Trump in the same way you have. But since this week, as you have come out strongly against Donald Trump, the rhetoric from some of your competitors has also heated up a bit. You're starting to see DeSantis use elevated rhetoric about Donald Trump. You're starting to see Vice President Mike Pence draw a slightly sharper contrast between him and his former boss, only slightly sharper, but still, it's you do notice that. Do you think there's a chance you are shifting the Overton window in terms of what is permissible in terms of criticizing President Trump?
I'd characterize it differently. I'd call it leadership. You know, leadership by definition is being out in front, being first, and saying things that need to be said. And if what that does is inspire the rest of the folks in this race to be better, then I think it shows an example to the American people of what I can do if I get a chance to be president for everybody in this country is to be daring and to articulate things in a way that make people want to follow. That's what I did in New Jersey for 8 years, in a state that's deeply blue. And that's what I would do as president. I would say, though, too, that while you are acknowledging some slight shifts by those folks, it's not nearly enough. It's not nearly enough for given what Donald Trump has done, and it's not nearly enough for them to win. There is only one path to winning, and that's beating Donald Trump. And the only way to beat someone, in my experience, is to draw the distinctions between you and them directly and honestly. I welcome any of the other people in this race to follow my lead.
There have been times in your past where you have been reticent to fully criticize Donald Trump. Even when your last book came out, Republican Rescue, and you were on this program, you were reluctant to say that you wouldn't support him necessarily if he had the nomination in 2024. So something has changed for you. What are they afraid of?
Well, I think it's different things for different folks, right? So I think some of the folks are afraid of him. They're afraid of him personally. They're afraid of his political force. They're afraid of his name calling. They're afraid of what impact that'll have on them. Some of them want jobs. Some of them want to be vice president. Some of them want to be in a cabinet. Some of them want that kind of political future that they believe Donald Trump could provide to them if they're defeated in this race by Trump, but not directly critical of him. I don't think that's the way to win in running for president. And what I would tell you is that I don't have any interest in any of that. And so, you know, I think for them, they're making those kind of, some of them are making calculated decisions. Some of them are making decisions based upon fear of political retribution. Some of them just don't want to be picked on by him because he's a bully.
What changed for you?
Look, I think over the course of time, Margaret, when someone continues to act in a way that you find completely unacceptable, I always believe, you know, and I think this is part of my religious background. I'm a Catholic. I believe in redemption. And I believe people can change. I've concluded he can't.
You newly concluded that?
I don't know how you would define newly, but certainly I continue to have hope that he might be able to change. But starting on election night 2020 and moving forward, I've concluded there's just no way he can. Because he doesn't want to.
So you always thought he was bad, but you used to believe he could get better.
I always thought that he was flawed. I don't know about bad. Then other times I thought he was bad. And ultimately, I hoped that through influence of good people that he had around him, myself included, Bill Barr, Mike Pompeo, Rex Tillerson, I mean, people who I think are really great people, good Americans, that would convince him there was another way to go. And I've convinced now that none of us could have the influence we needed to have over to change him. And the biggest reason why is he doesn't want to change, Margaret.
A federal indictment of the former president appears imminent. There are reports this week that the former president was notified that he's a target of the Department of Justice's investigation. Former Vice President Mike Pence was asked about this in a CNN town hall. And Pence answered like this.
Let me be clear that no one's above the law. But I would just hope that there would be a way for them to move forward without the dramatic and drastic and divisive step of indicting a former president of the United States. We've got to find a way to move our country forward and restore confidence in equal treatment under the law in this country. We really do.
So essentially in the same breath, he's like, everybody's equal under the law, but if the Department of Justice believes that he committed a crime, former Vice President Mike Pence believes they should not indict. Do you agree?
No. And worse yet, what Mike seems to be saying there is, let's find some other way to deal with this. What is he talking about? Like, I hope that someone asks him, what does he mean by that? Look, if you're going to say I'm committed to the rule of law, which he said no one's above the law. I agree with that, too. And that the law applies to everyone. I agree with that, too. Well, then, if he committed a crime and there is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that crime, then he must be charged, he must be tried. And a jury will then make the determination as to whether the government has met their level of proof or not, because he's presumed innocent under our Constitution, and no matter who you are, you should be. But It is ridiculous, in my view, to say that someone who you believe is guilty of committing a crime shouldn't be charged. The fact is, he's a private citizen. He is nothing but a private citizen. Yes, he was the president of the United States, and that's what prevented him from being indicted on other matters while he was there, because our Constitution provides the sole remedy being impeachment and then a trial to determine removal from office. In this instance, and I can tell you this, Margaret, because I did it, I took an oath when I became United States Attorney for New Jersey. And that oath requires me to use my judgment to enforce the law without fear. And if that's the case, and if Jack Smith has evidence that he believes proves the president's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, he has no choice but to bring that case, because that's the oath he's taken.
You're a prosecutor, though. What is your view of prosecutorial discretion with a former president?
Well, everyone, you have prosecutorial discretion with everyone, okay? And you should exercise that discretion. I think Alvin Bragg should have executed that discretion in Manhattan on a case that was 7 years ago that I don't think increases or enhances the safety and security of the people of Manhattan in any way, okay? This is different, because what we're talking about here is the potentially illegal retention and use of classified documents regarding American national security. That's different than paying 140 grand to a porn star. And the damage, potential damage to our country, both by that act, but also by allowing a president to do that and face no ramifications for it, sets back the rule of law in our country. So the thing I don't understand about Mike's answer is that if you believe in the rule of law, then you must believe in the rule of law. And I guess he's asking for Smith to exercise prosecutorial discretion, but I don't know on what basis he should exercise, just because the guy was president? I don't think, because remember, these crimes occurred, if they were crimes, after he left office. He was a private citizen, not the president of the United States.
I think Vice President Pence was making the case that it will be unnecessarily divisive to prosecute a former president. Do you agree?
I understand the argument if we need to move on, but he hasn't moved on. Now, if Donald Trump were no longer a candidate for public office, maybe there might be some difference there. But he is now seeking the presidency of the United States. He does not want to move on. And so if he doesn't want to move on, I think that's a very thin excuse for asking a prosecutor to move on.
Several of your fellow candidates have suggested that investigations into Trump are politically motivated. Do you think any charges from Special Counsel Jack Smith would be political?
I'd have to read the charges first, Margaret, but look, I'm a veteran of the Department of Justice. I know it's had troubles over the last 10 years, starting during the Obama administration. And I think there were political things done during the Obama administration. And I think there were political things done now in the Biden administration. So I think there are problems with the DOJ, but I'm not gonna come to any prejudgment on it until I see the evidence and the facts that they put forward. When I looked at Alvin Bragg's indictment, I came to the conclusion that it was political. But you only can make that judgment once you actually get any indictment that may come. So I'm not gonna make that judgment now, but I will acknowledge that there have been times in the Department of Justice over the last 10 years where it's not the place that I worked in the early and mid-2000s, where I could tell you, Margaret, I did 130 prosecutions of political corruption in New Jersey. We never lost a case, and I never once got a phone call from the White House, from John Ashcroft, or from Alberto Gonzalez, asking me to do something on a political thing or not do something. And I fear that that may not be the case in some of the DOJs that have come since then.
What reforms need to happen at DOJ?
The biggest reform is you need to have an attorney general who says that's unacceptable.
You don't think Merrick Garland's doing that?
I don't know, but we're going to find out with some of the things that are coming forward now. I don't believe Eric Holder did that for certain. And I'll tell you this, and I don't think Jeff Sessions was strong enough to do it. I think Bill Barr did it. And I think Bill Barr was clear and strong. When you see a strong attorney general, I could tell you that before I took the oath as U.S. attorney, the attorney general of the United States at the time, John Ashcroft, who I have extraordinary respect for, he called me down to his office, and he did this with every one of us, and told us what he expected of us. And one of the things he told us was, I never once want you to consider politics in anything you do. And if you do, and I find out you did, you'll be fired. When a boss sets that type of tone from the top in the beginning, you're not going to see people go astray. And if they do, he'll fire them. And General Ashcroft, I'm confident, would have done that.
Look, being indicted by the Manhattan DA did not hurt Trump's standing with Republican primary voters. His lead has only grown since then. If there is a federal indictment, how will that impact the race?
Not sure, but it's significantly different, I think, than the Manhattan issue. Look, I equate Donald Trump to Bill Clinton in this regard. They're both scoundrels, okay, with women. We know that about them. And we knew that when we elected them. And we incorporated that into our judgment of them. No one thought that Bill Clinton was not someone who stepped out and did things that were inappropriate. And Donald Trump admitted as much on tape in a number of different instances, right? So I think that people look at that and say, look, some people may not like it, some people may not care, but it was like, we know that already about them. And we don't want them going to jail for that, thank you, in the same way that people were offended by the things that were taken after on Bill Clinton at times. This is different. This is about how you conduct yourself in the office with the nation's secrets and things that you and only you are entitled to see as president of the United States. So I don't know exactly how it'll affect it, Margaret, but it is markedly different than paying a porn star money to keep quiet that you allegedly had a relationship with. You know, I think the American people probably believe he did have a relationship with her in the main, and they don't care because they said, we knew that about Donald Trump going in, and we certainly don't think it's something he should go to jail for.
Why do you think Donald Trump took the documents?
Well, I've always said that I think he took them because he wanted to pretend he was still president. He can't live with the idea that he lost to Joe Biden. And quite frankly, you know, I can understand that. Joe Biden's never beaten anybody outside the state of Delaware other than Donald Trump. And so the idea to lose to someone who, to me, looks so clearly incompetent in the job has got to be a bitter bit of medicine to swallow, to know that you lost to 78-year-old, then 78-year-old Joe Biden. And I think the documents were just one of the trappings of office that he wanted to take back with him, to wave around and show people and act important. That's what his ego is all about. He wants to continue to act like he's president. He wants to continue to believe he's president because his ego won't permit him to accept that he lost.
Do you think there could be anything even more nefarious?
I don't. I really don't.
You don't think the information he has and classified documents might be valuable to other sovereign nations?
I don't think that's ever been Donald Trump's motivation. I really don't. I've known him for a long time. I think this is purely about his own ego. And the idea that some of the stuff was kept in his desk drawer, where they found it when they did the raid, this is stuff that he wants to keep close to him to remind himself he was president and remind everybody else that he was president.
You said many things I found very refreshing in your announcement to be president this week in New Hampshire. And one of the things you said, very few individuals, especially challenging Trump, have mentioned. You essentially accused the Trump family of stealing from taxpayers to enrich themselves.
The grift from this family is breathtaking. It's breathtaking. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Kushner walk out of the White House and months later get $2 billion from the Saudis. $2 billion from the Saudis. You think it's because he's some kind of investing genius? Or do you think it's because he was sitting next to the president of the United States for 4 years doing favors for the Saudis? That's your money. That's your money he stole and gave it to his family.
You noted the $2 billion that Jared Kushner's new firm secured from a Saudi investment fund 6 months after he left the White House. What is your understanding of how Kushner's firm secured that deal?
I don't have a personal understanding of how they did it, but I'll tell you what I see as the circumstantial evidence. First of all, let's remember, Donald Trump, in a way that's almost unprecedented, and I think maybe unprecedented for inside the White House, hired his daughter and his son-in-law to be government employees in the White House. First off, I think a hugely bad decision in general to hire your family. But secondly, it's bad because they had absolutely no experience to hold the jobs they had. Secondly, on Jared Kushner, what was he doing gallivanting all over the Middle East? We had a Secretary of State in Rex Tillerson. We had a Secretary of State in Mike Pompeo, both of whom extraordinarily well-credentialed, experienced men who had traveled the world, Mike having served in the military as director of the CIA, Rex the CEO of one of the biggest corporations in the world. And yet we had the president's son-in-law being authorized by the president to undercut secretaries of state and to be dealing directly, and we know he dealt directly, with the leader of Saudi Arabia on a number of issues, in addition to other foreign leaders in the Middle East. And then are we supposed to expect that it's just coincidence that Jared Kushner gets $2 billion 6 months after he leaves office from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund? Is it because of his great investing acumen? And he is the guy who bought 666 Fifth Avenue, which was a monumental loser for his own family. So I don't know what motivated the Saudis. I'd have to investigate it to find the evidence to do it. But what I will tell you is that the idea of having a president's family in the White House exercising authority like that and then finding that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is something that should really worry people about returning that family to the Oval Office. And let me say this, Margaret, this very well could apply to President Biden as well. There is beginning growing evidence that Hunter Biden, Jim Biden, other members of the Biden family have used then Vice President Biden's influence to make money from the private sector. And I hope that those issues are brought forward too, because if we're going to have a justice system that truly respects the rule of law, if Hunter Biden committed those crimes and any other member of the Biden family traded on Joe Biden's position as vice president, that's just as big a grift as what the Trumps were doing as well. And that makes us look like a banana republic.
I just want to be really clear. Is it then straight corruption to trade on the office of the presidency for your own pocketbook if you're a member of the president's family?
Yes, of course it is. Even if it's not illegal, it's not right. And it's not what you get sent to the office to have done. But particularly wrong in the situation with Donald Trump, where he gave them government jobs, where they had not apparent influence, which is what Hunter Biden had, but they had actual influence in jobs where they could access the levers of power. Hunter Biden's influence was apparent influence, and it looks like he exercised it fairly frequently. Both are bad.
But on the case of the Trumps, in the case that the children were staff at the White House, and by the way, I should mention that Jared Kushner had actually been denied a security clearance, which was then overridden by the president himself. Should family members of presidents be allowed to work in the White House?
No. This isn't hard. You know, this topic came up when I was running the transition for President Trump, then candidate Trump. And I urged him at the time, he asked me about Jared and Ivanka in particular. And I said, don't hire them. And he said, why not? And I said, you should never hire someone you can't fire. And you can't fire somebody you have to have Thanksgiving with.
You famously prosecuted Jared Kushner's father, sent him to prison for charges including tax evasion, witness tampering involving a prostitute, and a video recording. One headline
about your latest comments about Jared Kushner was, quote, Chris Christie just made the GOP primary pettier with his deep beef against the Kushners. Is this current allegation a serious allegation of yours, or is it just an ongoing feud between you and the Kushners?
You know, and I don't think probably your viewers know this, and I don't think you do. I never met Charles Kushner until 2021. I never met him. I prosecuted him. I saw him across the courtroom, sitting in the gallery. I never met him. The idea that I have some kind of personal axe to grind with the Kushner family is absurd. I did my job. He committed crimes. And by the way, let me remind your audience, crimes that he pled guilty to. This was not a jury finding him guilty where he'd say, they were wrong, I wasn't guilty. He stood up and pled guilty to every count in the criminal complaint that we brought. And so, by the same token, you know, I didn't see that story that you referenced. I've been pretty busy. But these are the same people who said that it was petty to go after Charles Kushner back in 2011, or rather 2004, rather. I had a job to do then. I did it. I'm a candidate for president now, and I think I have an obligation to give my observations and my thoughts on the people in this race and how they've conducted themselves when they've had the privilege of being in public life.
The same Saudi investment fund that is tied to Jared Kushner's firm also backs the LIV Golf tournament, the LIV Golf Circuit, which announced its partnership with the PGA this week. Since January 6th, the PGA has blacklisted Trump's golf courses. But LIV still uses Trump-owned golf courses, and Eric Trump has declined to say whether his family played any role in the LIV PGA deal. Does all of this raise new concerns about Trump's financial conflicts of interest if he were to return to the White House?
Look, there's so many different areas of that potentially that, you know, it's incredibly hard to even untie the knots. But let me say, I was completely shocked that the PGA decided to make a deal with LIV Golf. I had heard the PGA saying that they were morally opposed to doing this. So I was shocked to see them do it. I don't know whether Donald Trump had anything to do with it or not.
Do you think he benefits financially from the merger?
Well, he certainly does, because the PGA Tour can now, I assume, once again, go to his golf courses, which they had refused to do before. And we know that he financially benefited from the LIV golf tournaments coming to his courses. So I'm sure he'll find a way to make money out of it. And by the way, if it ever looks like it was a really smart thing to do, you can be sure he'll take credit for it, whether he had anything to do with it or not.
You've been really clear about what you view Donald Trump's role and responsibility in the January 6th Capitol attacks. Was Michael Fanone, one of the Capitol police officers who was injured on that day, suffered a heart attack, later testified in front of the January 6th committee, has said, I'm paraphrasing it, that we have seen what Trump is willing to do, and if he has returned to office, there's nothing that will keep him from doing it again. What do you think the consequences of a second Trump term could be?
It doesn't matter what I think, Margaret. Let's just listen to what he said. He said, I will be your retribution.
So what do you think that would look like in a second term?
I think he will take retribution against anyone who he believes wronged him.
Who could that
Not
be?
Not wronged America. Wronged him. Who could it be? It could be anybody. It could be anybody who said that they think the election wasn't stolen. It could be those who he thinks pursued prosecutions against him, whether they were justified or not. Could be anything. But here's what we know it won't be. It won't be to try to uplift the American people. It won't be to try to make the country stronger and better. It won't be about anyone other than Donald Trump, because it's never about anyone other than Donald Trump. And he's a transactional guy. He believes if he does something for you, you must do something in return for him. There is no generosity of heart or spirit. I'm not seen him do that since he became president or in the year subsequent.
Do you think a second Trump term would be dangerous for the American experiment.
I don't think he should be president again, and that's why I'm running.
In your town hall earlier this week, you talked about some of your shortcomings and your failings and what you've learned from them. You talked explicitly about the controversy called Bridgegate and what you learned from it. You said one of the things you learned is that you had trusted the wrong characters. Characters without character. You had previously been friends with Donald Trump. How should the American people judge that you have learned how to judge character?
Watch me and listen to me. I mean, look, and I want to be clear about the Bridgegate folks. I didn't exactly say they were characters without character.
I said that.
Right. What I said was that I put them in positions of trust that they wound up not deserving, and that they made mistakes that I ultimately had to be accountable for. And so some of those people that were involved in that have no character, and some of them do. But all of them made mistakes. And it was my mistake, having put people in that position, that would think for a moment that any of the stuff they participated in was okay. And on Donald Trump, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I've explained over and over why I supported him in 2016. And I've acknowledged that my hope that I could make him a better candidate and a better president was wrong. But I think what people should judge about me is, do you think it's a strength or a weakness to admit when you've made a mistake? See, if you think it's strong to never admit you're wrong, never admit you made a mistake, always blame somebody else when something goes wrong, and always take all the credit for what goes right, whether you deserve it or not, your candidate is out there and his name is Donald Trump. But I believe that leadership shows its strength, not only in moments where they're right, but in moments when they make an honest mistake and they admit it. And so I'm always going to admit when I've made mistakes. I did that during my governorship, and I'll reaffirm that now. If you're looking for the perfect candidate, I am not the perfect candidate. But if you want a perfect candidate, all you're going to get is somebody who's lying to you about being perfect, because none of us are perfect.
Is one of your imperfections the inability to judge who is trustworthy?
No. I picked thousands of people to work for me when I was governor, and there were three that disappointed me. I'll take that track record.
And Donald Trump.
Well, I didn't pick him to work for me.
You went to work for him.
Kind of, yes. But you know what? It wasn't that I misjudged his character. It was that I was hopeful I could make him better. And I wound up failing in that way. And he wound up failing me and failing the country.
This week, religious broadcaster and presidential candidate on the Republican side, Pat Robertson, passed away at the age of 93. In 1987, he appeared on the original Firing Line with William F. Buckley Jr. And this is what he said then. Take a look.
One possible result of your candidacy is that it might move the Republican Party further to the right, out of the mainstream of American politics.
50 to 60% of my audience have been Democrats, and I'm switching Democrats to the Republican Party by the thousands. I'm a Democrat who turned Republican because I just couldn't buy the platform they put together out in San Francisco in 84. That's my goal, to broaden the party, not do it with shrinking.
Pat Robertson left a lasting imprint on the Republican coalition. How do you see that legacy?
I see it as predominantly good. I think he was right with what he said in that clip. I think he was trying to broaden the party. And I think if we as Republicans aren't willing to accept former Democrats who listen to us and say, you know what, I agree with them more, or listen to their own party and say, I can't be here anymore, then we're never going to expand our party to where it needs to be.
Well, I think of you as a successful two-term Republican governor from a blue state. And I think about the Republican Party, which has won, since 1988, one presidential election with a popular vote. And I wonder why the Republican primary nominating process doesn't look to people who could win nationally, like Republican governors from blue states. Do you think about what kind of reforms could be done to the Republican primary process in order to
put forth more nationally competitive candidates?
You know, I don't necessarily think it's been a failure of process as much as it's been a failure of candidates. Look, Mitt Romney won the primary. He's a Republican governor from a blue state of Massachusetts. And he won the primary in 2012. So we've seen it happen.
Attacking hard to the right and disowning many of his popular policies from Massachusetts.
Well, look, but in the end, I think you are who you are, Margaret. And if you try to do that and
that was the problem with Romney, is that nobody knew who he was.
Well, I think that there were a number of issues that made it harder for Governor Romney to win that race. But I don't believe that he couldn't have won the primary as the governor of Massachusetts. I don't think that it's about geography. I think it's about how you come across to people and do you seem authentic. I think maybe Mitt's larger problem was that some people didn't see him as authentic. And I think that's a problem. Donald Trump, by the way, won the Republican nomination for president after having written checks to Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton. If it was a process problem, I think Donald Trump would not have won. He won because he overcame all that in a way that people thought was real and authentic. He did. It was a force of his personality that won him that nomination. So I don't necessarily think it's a process issue. I think it's how powerful is the candidate and his or her message. Because I think if there's a powerful message given, candidates who aren't supposed to win can win. For instance, like Barack Obama also in the Democratic side in 2008. He was down by 40 points at this time in 2007 to Hillary Clinton. But it was the power of his message and his personality to Democratic primary voters that overcame huge institutional obstacles to him getting that job with superdelegates and all the rest that were all for Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. So I think it goes back to the one maxim about politics that I believe applies, whether it's for the school board or for president, the candidate matters most.
Smoke from hundreds of wildfires throughout Canada has descended on the northeast of the United States this week, filling New York skies. You have previously acknowledged climate change is real and that humans are contributing to it. Do you think climate change is an existential threat, and how will you prioritize it if you are president?
I think the only way that we're going to deal with climate change is to engage the whole world in trying to change climate change and trying to change the climate. So one of the challenges with the Chinese that you're going to confront as president is to say, if we want to try to change the climate, we can't exclude, you know, the billion plus people in China from the solution and think that 330 million people in the United States are going to be able to solve it by themselves. Fact is, we've done a lot as a country over the course of the last two decades to improve our carbon output. The Chinese have done nothing to do that. So this is a world problem that we're going to have to deal with. And I think the next president, if you care deeply about this issue, which people should, it is the future of our planet. We need to engage with China on getting them to join in trying to make the climate cleaner and safer. But to think, as some environmentalists in this country do, that if America unilaterally does what we do, we're going to have any kind of enormous change on the climate worldwide. I think what's happening this week with the fires from Canada, that we have nothing to do with, but we see how it's impacting us. That's the way the world turns, Margaret. And so to me, I think a president needs to show leadership on that issue, not just by having Americans do what we can to make it better, but by engaging other countries and saying, America will lead with you, but not without you. So the Chinese need to be a part of this, and they haven't been. And enough with them saying, we're having our industrial revolution. You had yours at the turn of the last century. No, they've had it. It's done. It's time for them to engage in it. And I would say one thing since you brought this up. I really believe and I saw it in my own state of New Jersey play out, that if we're going to solve this problem, nuclear energy has to be a part of the solution. People would be surprised to know that in the densest populated state in the country, New Jersey, we are the most densely populated. 53% of our electricity, when I was governor, was created by nuclear. Now, if we can run these plants in the most densely populated state in America safely, we can run them anywhere in America. And it is the cleanest energy and the most reliable clean energy we can have. So I hope that as we look at this as a country, I was alive, I don't know if you were, and aware during Three Mile Island. I was in high school when it happened. That's when I was in high school. It's 45 years ago. And it's time for us to understand that nuclear technology has evolved and we need to make it a part of what we're doing here. And the reluctance by some environmentalists to embrace that and to say, no, 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 we should embrace more unreliable clean energy sources first makes no sense to me. And it will not support American industry appropriately. And it won't support the lifestyle of the American people appropriately. So if I were to become president, one of the ways I would try to lead domestically would to be able to lead a new renaissance in encouraging our states to permit more nuclear energy. It's safer than it's ever been, and it's clean. And we can help the environment and have a sustainable and reliable grid for our industry and our people to be able to use to live their lives.
Is there one other issue that you think differentiates you?
Look, I talked about this this past week. I'm always someone who's gone into public office to do big things. I'm not into small ball. I'm not into picking the little issues out of the crosstab of a poll that people seem to like and then take big bows for it. When I was governor, I took on property taxes, which were the largest in the country. I took on a $300 billion pension and benefit debt in our state. Took on charter schools and expanding them throughout the state, larger than they've ever been, and fired the entire Camden Police Department because they were the most dangerous city in America. And now today, 10 years later, murder is down 67% in Camden because we did that. The difference between me and these other candidates is that I want to do the big things for this country to make America bigger, greater, bolder than it's ever been. And I think a lot of other people are preoccupied with smaller things that they think give them a greater political advantage. I'm not trying to win a political advantage for myself. I'm trying to make this the greatest country it can possibly be. And it's by doing the big things that America's always become great.
Chris Christie, thank you for joining me on Firing Line. We're going to be following closely.
Thank you, Margaret, for having me.